Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Phil Dierking and Anna Mateo. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, Brazil is the largest exporter of soybeans, chicken, and beef in the world. It is also a major producer of pork and corn. The Reuters news agency says Brazil's success is partly a result of low prices for farmland and permissive land use policies. Some farmers are leaving the Amazon, partly because of international concerns about the rainforest. Many are moving to an area in the center of the country known as the Cerrado. The Cerrado is about the same size as Mexico. It stretches from Brazil's western border with Paraguay up to the northeast and the Atlantic Ocean. It is the largest flat wooded grasslands in South America. The area is also home to 5% of living species on Earth. Over the past 10 years, Brazilian farmers have been developing large parts of the Cerrado. The government says the area has lost more than 105,000 square kilometers of its native plant cover since 2008. That number represents 50% more land than the deforestation seen during the same period in the Amazon. Based on relative size, the Cerrado is disappearing nearly four times faster than the rainforest. The Cerrado is also rich in carbon dioxide gas. Studies have linked rising levels of carbon dioxide to rising temperatures in Earth's atmosphere. Many scientists blame the increase on deforestation and use of coal, oil, and other fossil fuels. Brazilian officials say protection of native plant life is important to meeting the country's goals under the 2016 Paris Agreement on climate change. But scientists say industrial farming in the Cerrado could hold back Brazil's efforts and worsen global warming. Liliana Peña Naval is an environmental engineering professor at the Federal University of Tocantins. She told the Associated Press that the removal of plants can cause bodies of water to disappear. Thousands of plants, fish, insects, and animals are also affected. Many of these species are only beginning to be studied. Farmers see the development of the Cerrado as necessary for Brazil's food security and economic success. The agriculture industry grew 13% in 2017. The ability to keep producing new farmland at low cost has given Brazil better chances for success than other countries. Deforestation in the Cerrado has slowed from the early 2000s. But farmers continue to develop large parts of the area. Much of the growth is fueled by Chinese demand for Brazilian meat and grain. China is Brazil's top buyer of soybeans. China is also a major purchaser of Brazilian pork, beef, and chicken. Rising trade tensions between China and the United States have only made the connection stronger. Brazil's soybean exports to China are up 18% through the first 7 months of 2018. The increase comes as Chinese buyers have canceled tens of millions of dollars worth of business deals with U.S. suppliers. Environmental protections remain strong in Brazil. Rainforest farmers are required by law to protect 80% of native plants on their land. As part of its promise under the Paris Agreement, the government agreed to end illegal Amazon deforestation by 2030. But Brazil has made no similar effort to protect the Cerrado. Environmentalists say the area's wooded grasslands have failed to capture the public's attention the way the Amazon has. Last year, some environmental protection groups began calling for large international businesses to protect the Cerrado. Among those groups were Greenpeace, the World Wildlife Foundation, and the Brazilian research group IPAM. They called for immediate action to end the deforestation in a document known as the Cerrado Manifesto. More than 60 companies, including McDonald's, Unilever, and Walmart, offered to follow the manifesto. They have agreed to support measures that would end native vegetation loss in the Cerrado from their production processes. Farmer Julimar Pancera purchased land in the Cerrado 7 years ago. Today, he oversees nearly 49 square kilometers of soy fields and has about 20 full-time employees. He said, "There is no future without growth." "There is still a large area to be opened," he said. "It will be one of the great centers of Brazilian agriculture."
Parts of Chile are facing a growing water crisis. The Reuters news agency reports the government is taking steps to protect the country's water supplies from mining operations. But for many years, the Chilean government's approved water extraction rights with little consideration for their effect on the environment. Mining companies were quick to claim the water available in the salt flats of the Salar de Atacama. The Salar sits in the world's driest desert. The water trapped below feeds the biggest copper mine in the world. The mine holds more than one-third of the world's known supply of lithium, a very light metal. Lithium is used to power batteries in electric vehicles. It also is used in mobile phones and laptop computers. Lithium can be extracted from water found in mines. However, demand for water has grown so much that the Chilean government is trying to limit its usage. No one really knows how much water there is in the Salar de Atacama area. Oscar Cristi was recently appointed head of Chile's water authority. He says the development agency Corfo hopes to provide more information after it releases a study in December. Corfo helps to oversee lithium mining in the Salar. The government, Cristi said, has been unwilling to propose bans on water extraction. The mining industry is paying attention to what he says. A few weeks ago, his agency ordered a ban on new permits to extract water from an aquifer that supplies water to BHP's Escondida mine, the world's largest copper mine. The agency is also preparing to create a drinking water reserve near the operations of top lithium producers SQM and Albemarle. The move would enable the government to further limit water use there. SQM and Albemarle say they have all the water rights they need and do not expect new limits to affect their current or future production of lithium. International demand for lithium is growing. Chile is home to nearly 50% of the world's reserves of the metal. However, there is plenty of competition for the water needed to mine lithium. Native groups, SQM and Albemarle, local copper miners, and newcomers to the area are all competing for water. Recently, SQM and Albemarle both signed deals with the government to sharply increase the amount of lithium they can remove from the salar. The two businesses say they will not use any more water than the amount already approved. New companies like Wealth Minerals, New Energy Metals, and Lithium Chile have also announced projects in the salt flats. I'm Phil Dierking.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. Many people take aspirin to help ease pain in the head or muscles. But there is another use for this pain-relieving medicine. Aspirin is often used as a blood thinner since it costs less than other treatments. Some doctors advise patients who have suffered a heart attack, stroke, or other heart problems to take a small amount of aspirin every day. Dr. Holly Anderson is a heart specialist with the New York Presbyterian Weill Cornell Medical Center in New York City.
It's clear that people who have had heart attacks or most strokes can benefit from taking a baby aspirin every day. It's very important. It reduces your future risk of stroke, heart attack, and can make you live longer.
Experts at the European Society of Cardiology agree. They wrote in a statement, "The benefit of aspirin for preventing a second heart attack or stroke is well established. Its use for preventing first events is controversial." The experts go on to say that warnings against using aspirin come from an increased risk of major bleeding. Now, major research has tested whether aspirin can help to prevent a first-time heart problem. Results from two large studies found that it cannot. A new American study involved more than 12,000 patients. They were all at moderate risk of a heart problem because of other issues like high blood pressure, high blood cholesterol, or smoking. These patients showed no improvement after taking aspirin. The other new aspirin-related study comes from the University of Oxford in Britain. It involved more than 15,000 adults with type 1 or type 2 diabetes. Other than this condition, these men and women were generally in good health and had no history of heart disease. Researchers ordered the subjects to take either aspirin, fish oil, both aspirin and fish oil, or a placebo, a harmless substance, every day. After 7.5 years, the aspirin users had fewer heart problems than the other subjects. But they also had more cases of serious internal bleeding. Researchers say these adults simply traded one risk for another. The lead investigator was Jane Armitage of the University of Oxford.
We also saw almost a 30% increased risk in major bleeding. So that was bleeding bad enough to get you into hospital, mainly from the gut, or bleeding into the eye or brain. And if it was into the eye, it was bad enough to threaten your sight.
The findings were announced last week at the European Society of Cardiology Congress in Munich, Germany. At that meeting, Dr. Armitage was asked about the possible health risks of taking aspirin. She told the Associated Press, "If you're healthy, it's probably not worth taking it." And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember.
For 4 years now, to realize our vision, we have pursued a simple but profound strategy. Opportunity for all, responsibility from all, a strong, united American community.
Americans elected Clinton as their 42nd president in 1992 and re-elected him 4 years later. In the summer of 1996, President Clinton's first term was coming to an end. He had established a mixed record of successes and failures in his dealings with Congress. He had greater difficulty in those dealings after opposition Republicans won control of Congress in 1994. All presidents face political battles, but in President Clinton's case, there was more to it. He and his wife, Hillary Rodham Clinton, were being investigated over their personal financial dealings in Arkansas during the 1980s. There were also accusations of womanizing from his years as governor of that state. But in the summer of 96, President Clinton's public approval ratings stayed above 50% and went as high as 60%. The economy had improved during his first term. Americans were getting jobs and spending more money. More people, and not just the wealthy, were investing in the stock market. In August of 1996, the Democratic Party met in Chicago and nominated President Clinton and Vice President Al Gore for a second term.
My fellow Democrats and my fellow Americans, thank you for your nomination. I don't know if I can find a fancy way to say this, but I accept.
The Republican Party held its nominating convention that summer in San Diego, California. The party chose former Kansas Senator Bob Dole as its presidential candidate. He had resigned from the United States Senate to seek the nomination. He chose former Congressman and Cabinet Secretary Jack Kemp of New York as his vice presidential running mate. Dole was a World War II hero who suffered a permanent injury to his right arm. He later served 4 terms in the House of Representatives. He was elected to the Senate in 1968 and re-elected 4 times. Another candidate in the presidential race was businessman Ross Perot. He won the nomination of the Reform Party, which he started a year earlier. He had also run for president in 1992 and received 19% of the popular vote. During the 96 campaign, President Clinton pointed to the stronger economy. He also campaigned on his legislative record, including new gun control measures and a higher minimum wage for the lowest paid workers. Bob Dole, in his campaign, accused President Clinton of spending too much. Clinton's answer was that he had stopped Congress from cutting too much from programs like health insurance for retirees. Bill Clinton and Al Gore easily won the election, defeating Bob Dole and Jack Kent. Ross Perot received just 8% of the popular vote this time. Clinton became the first Democrat to win a second term since Franklin Roosevelt in 1936. William Jefferson Clinton began his second term as President of the United States on January 20, 1997. His inaugural speech would be the last by an American president in the 20th century.
Let us lift our eyes toward the challenges that await us in the next century. It is our great good fortune that time and chance have put us not only at the edge of a new century and a new millennium, but on the edge of a bright new prospect in human affairs. A moment that will define our course and our character for decades to come. We must keep our old democracy forever young.
Clinton discussed some of the issues that the country continued to face, including racial divisions.
The divide of race has been America's constant curse. And each new wave of immigrants gives new targets to old prejudices. Prejudice and contempt cloaked in the pretense of religious or political convictions are no different.
During his first term, President Clinton appointed a large number of women and minorities to the government. As he began his second term, he chose the first woman to serve as Secretary of State. Madeleine Albright had represented the United States in the United Nations during Clinton's first term. And he appointed the first Asian American to serve in the cabinet. Norman Mineta became Secretary of Commerce. The Republican Party kept control of both houses of Congress in the 1996 elections. At the end of his first term, Clinton had gotten into a budget fight with the Republicans, which resulted in two government shutdowns. Those shutdowns did more political harm to the Republicans than to the president. In 1997, they reached a compromise. They agreed to a plan to end the federal deficit by 2002. In fact, the budget was balanced much sooner. In 1998, the economy was so strong that the government found itself with an extra $70 billion, the first surplus since 1969. President Clinton visited China in 1998. He spoke of his belief that in the 21st century, democracy will be the right course practically as well as morally, yielding more stability and more progress. A month later, in August of 1998, Al-Qaeda terrorists bombed the American embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. The attacks killed more than 200 people. President Clinton ordered missile strikes against Al-Qaeda targets in Sudan and in Afghanistan in an effort to kill the group's leader, Osama bin Laden. Later in the year, President Clinton ordered military action in response to Iraq's refusal to cooperate with United Nations inspectors. The inspectors were searching for nuclear, chemical, or biological weapons. Clinton ordered missile strikes against targets that UN officials said could have been linked to such weapons of mass destruction.
Their mission is to attack Iraq's nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons programs and its military capacity to threaten its neighbors. Their purpose is to protect the national interest of the United States and indeed the interests of people throughout the Middle East and around the world. Saddam Hussein must not be allowed to threaten his neighbors or the world with nuclear arms, poison gas, or biological weapons.
In 1999, Clinton deployed American aircraft and missiles as part of a NATO campaign in Yugoslavia. NATO was trying to stop attacks against ethnic Albanians in Kosovo. Yugoslav military leaders agreed to withdraw their troops. NATO stopped the bombing and sent an international peacekeeping force to Kosovo. The United States provided 7,000 troops for that force. Earlier in Clinton's presidency, the United States had led NATO airstrikes against Serb targets in the former Yugoslav Republic of Bosnia. The operations followed the killing of 8,000 Muslim men and boys by Bosnian Serb forces in Srebrenica, a UN-declared safe area. Clinton later pushed for the 1995 peace agreement to end the Bosnian War. The Dayton Peace Accords were named after Dayton, Ohio, the location of the Air Force base where they were negotiated. 3 years later, in 1998, Israeli and Palestinian leaders signed a Memorandum of Understanding at the White House. It called for Israeli forces to withdraw from some areas of the West Bank. The Y Memorandum resulted from 9 days of negotiations at the Y River Plantation in Maryland. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright and Special Diplomat Dennis Ross traveled repeatedly to the Middle East to work on the peace efforts. In 2001, President Clinton tried to get Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat and Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak to sign a peace agreement. Clinton invited the two leaders to the United States and held many hours of talks with them. Reports said they came close to an agreement, but the negotiations ended without success. Palestinians declared a new uprising against Israel. On trade issues, President Clinton, at the end of his second term, got Congress to approve permanent normal trade relations with China. That meant no more need for presidents to have to ask Congress for temporary renewals of those trade rights. Clinton argued that the move would create a better environment for democratic reforms in China, as well as creating jobs in the United States. Among other foreign policy matters during his presidency, Clinton normalized relations with Vietnam, and he supported the expansion of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, in Europe. Bill Clinton's presidency will be remembered, at least in part, for his efforts to reach out to the international community. But it will also be remembered for the impeachment trial in Congress that almost ended that presidency.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.